Come up to the microphones because it assists in tape recording and also hearing.
Mr. Graham, we brought up this question in the group. It seemed that no one was too sure, you know, what the university's role had in land claims form and what it had actually in the community. So they want to know, how was the land claims form conceived by the university and how does it fit into its general purposes?
Okay. The University of Canada North is an idea, mostly, that's been kicking around since about 1971. There is a Canada Corporations Act incorporation, a charter as a nonprofit organization, as a university in the north. However, the only current activity is in the Yukon. As far as we know, there's nothing active in the NWT. In August of 1976, the Yukon Native Brotherhood sent a letter to quite a few community organizations in Whitehorse asking about the utility of a public information forum on land claims. And as a result of that letter and the discussions of those organizations, it was agreed by all of them that the University of Canada North would be a good agency to coordinate such a forum. And we then formed an advisory group that consisted of observers from CYI and from the territorial government and from the Federal Land Claims Office, and representatives from Native organizations and white community organizations, and we basically came up with the four-program format that you've been seeing. How does it fit in with University of Canada North's objectives? At the moment, UCN is simply the board of directors, which consists of 15 people. And as a result of this forum project, and as a result of an interest in some of the people who were participating in the LISIC inquiry to have some independent studies done, we've had an opportunity to revitalize and bring the University of Canada North back on stream. I think that one of the uses of a university is to assist people in their community in understanding the things that are taking place around them so that they can better participate in public life. And I think that would be the way in which the public information forum could be fit into a university concept. I could go on all night, but I'll stop there.
Mr. Weber, what will happen to land claims if they are not settled before the pipeline right-of-way is established?
I wish I could give you factual information, but I believe, are you saying what are the Indian organizations going to do about it if the land claims aren't settled? Just for clarification, question that you're asking.
Yeah, what do they feel will happen to their claims if they're not settled before them? I mean, I realize it's a major point of apprehension, but...
One of the things we feel that the sort of the major thrust right now by huge developers is the pipeline, and if that was gone ahead before pipelines were settled, before land claims were settled, pardon me, then Indian people and especially a lot of other Yukoners would lose out on a lot of the positive benefits and only receive the negative impacts of a pipeline.
Mr. Burko, will the regional corporation concept be used in this area? And if so, what role would the individual have in determining the use of the proceeds from settlement, that is the lands and the money that comes from the settlement?
I think there will be one major organization to hold land and money, but there will also be smaller community-style corporations that would and a lot less money. Go in that direction with. We haven't researched that out far enough yet to give you a good answer on it.
Mr. Nutty, most of the most of the points that you brought out from land claims in Alaska seem to be rather negative. Were there any or very many positive aspects that you could dwell on perhaps for a moment here?
Well, I'm not sure. I didn't mean everything to be negative. There are a number of positive things, sure. I think it gives the native people an opportunity to contribute something to the economic system in Alaska. It also gives the native people an opportunity to get into businesses that they would never have the opportunity to get into without land claims. And I think from that point of view, that's one positive aspect.
I'm not sure who I can direct this final question to. I think we need Dr. Hartman here or someone. But what statistics are being kept on the depletion of renewable resources, fish and game and so forth, especially in the outlying areas or areas where hunting licenses aren't required? And where would these records be kept?
Paul, have you got any statistics on wildlife resources?
Well, we have. We did a questionnaire this summer, and not to find out exactly where all the game are, but to find out how many the amount of game that people have taken, and the amount of trapped furs that they have taken, amount of fish, and pretty well quite a bit of the game that were done, but no study on the amount of game that are left. I think that game department has done a survey on the amount of moose that are around. They've done it last year, I think. Some took a survey on certain areas.
Anybody else on the panel want to comment on that? Peter? On how you collect such...
Well, I certainly can't comment on the Yukon situation, but the thing that has become evident to me in the research that I'm aware of what Native people actually are harvesting, and is that any study that relies on government statistics, which biologists know and game managers know were not designed to and do not in fact really provide an accurate picture of the total harvest. If economists go ahead and use those, supposing that they do, their studies are going to be wrong. They're going to make significant underestimates.
Okay, any more, Jerry, or another group?
You use when you're choosing the investments that you make. Do you have some sort of? Do you look into, say, the philosophy of the company? Do you look at the, or do you look at sort of their profit margins, or a mixture of the two?
Well, there are a number of things we look at. First of all, if it's a local company, will there be any conflicts with village lifestyle? If there is, we stay away from it. We have not done anything near the villages that would, in exploration or any type of business that would conflict with village lifestyle. And of course, we look at the rate of return. We're not in business to make bad investments and lose money. So we do have to look at the businesses. When we do look at the businesses, we consider several things. We consider whether it will provide the training or jobs for our stockholders. That would weigh heavily on if it was a marginal business and it could provide a lot of employment, it would bear some weight, as opposed to making a lot of money and not providing any employment. There are some businesses, of course, we stay away from that just do not have a good public image. If it's good for the community, it's good for the company, we consider it favorably. We get proposals every day from all kinds of businesses, and we've turned away more than we've gone into.
So some of the major investments that you've made?
Well, one of the investments that we've made is we own a hotel in Hawaii. And we take the tourist business to cover some of our overhead back in Fairbanks, which is not a bad thing. It has no impact, local impact, and we take advantage of of people spending money in Hawaii. In Anchorage, we own part of a surveying company, and we hope, and in fact it has, the surveying company has done surveys around villages, and we hope to do more for the federal government before they transfer title. We're involved in an asbestos company as we do some exploration for asbestos, but that's, you know, that's long range. The investment won't pay off for 5 years if it pays off at all. So there's some speculation there. We own the office building that we're in Fairbanks, and we lease 2 floors and occupy 1 floor ourselves. And there are a number of, you know, that's a sampling of the kinds of businesses we're into.
Frank, go ahead.
This is a group question for Paul. The first two parts of which are tied into the importance of renewable resources. Is there going to be a residency clause part of the negotiations for hunting, for fishing, and for voting, and voting both on a territorial and municipal levels?
Well, we're hoping to have some type of a residency clause, but I think we're still a negotiating item, and a lot of our people are asking for it right now in the communities, you know, especially in the game side of it, and you know, and the voting side of it too.
Much of the discussion in our group centered around the Dr. Peter Usher's discussion of the options of style, of lifestyles, and how to balance renewable resource, drawing assessments from renewable resources as well as cash. So question number one is, if renewable resources are already depleted, as both Paul Birkel and Billy Weber have indicated they have been, such as salmon, how are these to be the basis of even a partial economy in the future? Is one question. I don't know whether you want to answer them one by one, or whether you want to respond at all to them, or whether there's anything to say. Dr. Usher?
Is that directed at me?
I guess.
Well,
so.
Not knowing the specific resource situation in the Yukon, I'm hardly in a position to comment. There may indeed be, in, you know, some cases and very significant cases of resource depletion in the Yukon, but there may also be cases of resources which are significantly underutilized. I'd be very surprised, for example, if timber resources were adequately utilized in the Yukon. When houses are built here, I wonder how many log houses there are. Is it because log houses are primitive, or because some company in Vancouver can make more money by shipping in prefabs? Where's your local training component in that? Where's your local managerial skills expertise going to be developed out of that? Where's your local labor component developed out of that? You know, I think one of the things that, you know, there's several avenues toward any kind of alternative development. They start with using the resources that you have. Second of all, you have to decide whether you really need all those things that you import. Not only the goods that you import, but whether the standards that are imposed on what you do from the outside are necessary. And I'll give you an example of One instance I know in a small community in the territories where people wanted to go into a motel business. And it seems to me that what they suffered from was the government, between the various levels of government, the strictures that were put on that development, as those people were invited to overinvest, massive overinvestment, and the thing's gone belly up. Well, people turn around and say, oh, well, you see, natives can't run an enterprise. Damn it, that's not true. That's the government's fault. You know, that's because unnecessary health standards were involved, unnecessary construction standards were involved. This is what I mean about the importance of local control. You know, if people are allowed to design economic development for their own needs and in their own way, then I think you'll see much more success in development projects than if totally irrelevant criteria and controls are put on them.
Mr. Naughty, would you care to respond to this particular question as well, in the sense that have you had any conflicts between resource-based and renewable resource-based economy and non-renewable resources or things that basically feed into the metropolis, into the southern metropolis as there?
Well, my view of the subsistence lifestyle is one that in Alaska, anyway, it's disappearing very fast, and I don't think it will ever come back. If we look at the caribou herds, if we take the Nelchina herd from around Glen Allen, 10 years ago there were 60,000 animals in that herd. Today there are 6,000 animals. If we take the moose population around Fairbanks, 10 years ago there were 20,000 animals, and today there are 2,000 animals. If you take the salmon catch for subsistence, I don't know the numbers, but I know it's declining. If you take any of those resources, and then you take subsistence use and competition with sports hunting and fishing, the land will not sustain both subsistence and sports hunting. State government, by constitution, cannot discriminate in the use of those resources, and if they could, they're not willing to. So where they can regulate seasons and limits, they refuse to do so. So in my view, the subsistence lifestyle, if not gone, is declining, and in time will disappear. So there is competition. So the native people and the villages have no choice but to get into wage economy, but they can still stay close to land, but that still means it's change in lifestyle, and that means getting into agriculture. There's a lot of good agricultural land, but not very much expertise in the area. There are some experimental programs going on now and some training programs that in the future I think will lead to more agricultural use of the land.
Would you include reindeer managing under that?
Yeah, there is some use of reindeer, and but that would not be subsistence. That will go towards commercial, because what it'll mean is in the future they'll get stainless steel slaughterhouses and USGA grade one stamp on them, and then they can export and sell to the commercial market. But that will be will not be subsistence, it will be commercial.
The next question relates to time and the conflict to time to build or to stabilize at least that part of the renewable resource base which we would like to maintain, and whether in fact there is enough time without declaring a moratorium on all other types of development such as pipelines for a while. Is there, in fact, enough time to make that a really realistic option? And it's thrown out to, probably with hindsight, to Mr. Naughty and possibly to Dr. Usher in terms of what projections were made in the Mackenzie Delta or the discussions surrounding the Mackenzie Delta and the impact of the pipeline there.
Well,
is it really basically the question says is, do we have a hope? You know, or in fact, can you scrap the whole, which is actually what you've just to one some degree have said, which is that we scrap the renewable resource as even an option?
I have a very pessimistic view on that. You know, there are a lot of planners that go around and talk about what's the optimum number of people for an area and what's optimum development and what kind of industry should move into an area, what kind of industry should be prevented. But when it comes right down to it, the people who make policy are not planners and they don't listen to the planners. So what happens is the commercial interests end up making the decisions. And so I think we're going to, in Alaska anyway, make the same mistakes that have been made in the other 49 states.
No more buffalo.
I'm sorry?
Say no more buffalo. Dr. Escher?
Well, I certainly in the Northwest Territories, parts of the northern provinces, I don't know about here, I think the it doesn't have to go that way yet. Mm-hmm. It hasn't gone that way, and there's time to do something differently. The argument that Justice Berger certainly accepted in relation to the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline was the importance of developing giving a sound development basis to the renewable resource economy, and that had to happen prior to major development, non-renewable resource development. That if that kind of development were in place, and that large-scale development subsequently happened with proper controls, the two could coexist.
Garth, this is for you. It's a very short one. Sorry.
Just before you do that, Phil, I wonder if our three Yukon panelists would like to comment on the question you've asked as to whether they perceive that there's time for
right.
this.
I think there would be time, but I think this is where we have to put in this type of game management and a lot of management ideas and some of the things that we're thinking about to be put forward at our negotiating table, and if we can get those implemented right away, I think we can probably save that. I think the problem with game depleting is nobody seems to be looking after it. And we have a lot of good ideas, and we have I think the Indian people have a lot of experience from years behind of preserving a lot of game and making it last, and I think we can still come up to it to do with that again.
Yes, I'd like to respond to the first question as well as the last one. And in regards to the salmon, I believe good management and some conservation measures, and also I think there's an option of hatcheries, which has taken place in other parts of the country, could replace that renewable resource. And another thing, I think that more provision should be made for accommodating renewable resources like fish when dams are put into place, like the Whitehorse Dam, for instance. They provided a fish ladder so that the fish could get up to spawn, but they didn't provide any means for the fingerlings to get back through that dam. So they wind up going through the turbine system, and they don't make it back. So very few get back. So I think if some of these things are taken into consideration, we can replenish some of our renewable resources there. And in regards to your last question, I believe that, well, I'm always optimistic that there is time, but we are under extreme pressure, and I believe we have to be able to move fairly quickly and try and resolve our land claims so that we can get some things in place prior to huge developments coming in.
On the last question, I'm not qualified to know whether there's time. What I'd like to be sure of is that there is a desire. And by that I mean, is there really a desire at the Indian village level for people to stay in a subsistence type of existence? Or do they really want to have, as Dr. Usher said, jobs and hunting? And if that's the case, we have to look at the economic development as well at the same time. And I think an ideal existence would be to have jobs and hunting. But I think we have to not have the either or choice that was being put.
Garth, this is a very short one. The group really seriously wanted to know why the Whitehorse newspapers have boycotted both of the last two meetings. There's been no reporting whatsoever on the forums.
There was a column by John Lammers, but other than that, there hasn't been any reporting per se. I haven't had any contact with the newspapers myself, but Rob Hornsey might have. Rob, would you care to comment on that? I see some representation from the Yukon Indian News, too, so we're not totally unrepresented by the media.
That was acknowledged in our group, by the way. The other question was, and this is probably to Billy and to Paul, is there a post-settlement planning process underway which would include all of what's been discussed in terms of planning for options for wages, for wage-type economy, as well as a resource or a traditional-type economy? Is that in the is there a cooperative or a general cooperative, was the name, the word used, or is there a comprehensive planning process for the post-settlement? Is that set up?
No, I don't think we have dealt in that too far. I mean, we have a lot of ideas that we want to put forward, but at the moment there are no concrete steps that we have come into. It's coming more and more into focus all the time, but it just needs more work on it. You know? We've got to put our ideas to paper and then come out with some better ideas.
There has been some work undertaken by Yukon Indian Futures Planning, which is a research structure which operates under a steering committee of CYI, Yukon Native Brotherhood, and Yukon Association of Non-Status Indian. And it has been doing some community profiles in a number of the highway communities now. And Dawson and Mayo, I believe, were done, Pelly, to get a feel right from the community level on exactly what the people's aspirations are, you know, as individuals at the community level. And there's fairly good documentation of that available right now.
There was some discussion of activities that are maintained, renewable resource activities that are maintained for their cultural or for other considered socially important reasons, even though they don't necessarily pay for themselves. One of the questions in our group was, who subsidizes those, and who decides what kinds of activities are allowed to survive on that basis? Do you want to answer that? Or is that?
Well, there seems to be different parts to your question, but the Indian organizations have certainly been looking into a lot of cultural preservation areas and partly language, partly handicrafts. And Yukon Indian Arts and Crafts Society was formed, and it has been making considerable effort through the Department of Indian Affairs to preserve the tannery arts and also, of course, beadwork. And, of course, language. I believe the Council for Yukon Indians has also recently supported a language project, which John Ritter has been working on.
The last question is to Mr. Ian Mackay, and that is, do businesses in fact feel or understand that Native people here have a right to a land claim, or does the business community consider it as basically another government handout or gift?
I have trouble answering on behalf of the whole business community on that one. We're certainly not unanimous in everything. My personal involvement has been that I've always supported land claims, and in fact, did give some assistance in the preparation of Together Today for Our Children Tomorrow. That's been my personal feeling, and it's a right, whether legal or moral, but nevertheless, it's something that has to be settled, and that I have no problems, accepting that as a concept. I think there are members of the business community who don't. And I guess that's my answer. I can't speak for everybody. I just can tell you how I feel about it.
Mr. Chair, and I promise I won't editorialize this week.
I'm not sure that I can ask these as questions. Our group sort of raised areas of concern and addressed issues. And I'd like to just put these issues out and have different members of the panel respond to them. We saw a number of, after the presentation, a number of conflicts in game management and game harvesting. Any kind of relationship to game management must also be tied to the land. You can't manage the game without managing the land as well. And we realize that that brings in many different jurisdictions. We also recognize that when in lands claims, certain areas are established for traditional use, under that second category you described, that the animals may not always stay within that zone that you've drawn, and they may move in and out of it. And when they move in and out of it, they move in and out of different jurisdictions. That's part of the question. The second part of the concern sort of dealt with the differences that rest between the game management philosophy that's in place in the Yukon and that which is in place in Alaska, and there's some substantial differences between those two. I'd like you either Paul or Bill to comment on the differences, and then possibly open up to the panel that sort of dilemma in management.
Yeah, I think in terms of management, I think if we have a say in our own lands, what we do about game, but also have a say in lands outside of our district, I think we can probably control it if we have some say, compatible to the two.
I'm not really aware of the game regulations in Alaska, but presently the Yukon Territorial Government are managing the Yukon game for us. But in regards to Indian management, I think Indian people have been managing the game and the country for thousands of years, and I think they've taken pretty good care of it. So I think it would be in good hands if there was Indian control of game and natural resources.
Maybe I could ask Naughty to describe what he meant when he said that the state will not recognize special hunting considerations for Native people in Alaska, and maybe you could elaborate what special considerations exist in our territory. There is a difference there, is there not, Mr. Naughty? It seemed to me as though you described one.
The fish and game belong to the state of Alaska, and the state of Alaska because of its constitution, cannot discriminate in the use, cannot give a preference, and especially a racial preference. And so they've tried to do it, I think it was tried in the past, to put in place regulations that would do it on an economic basis. They had subsistence permits for 25 cents to catch salmon. Now, my feeling is those regulations were put in place to allow people who could not afford a $10 license fee to catch salmon for their own use. The Fish and Game Department chose to interpret that those regulations to mean that if you didn't sell it, you could use it. So you had people who had full-time jobs and could drive out there in a camper and fly out there in an airplane to take as many fish as they wanted to, as long as they didn't sell it on a 25-cent subsistence permit. And that's what it was called, a subsistence permit. So on the one hand, the state cannot regulate on a racial basis. And secondly, when they try to do it on an economic basis, because most of the need is in low-income areas, it has not been implemented. And the pressures are growing. They are strong and they are growing for sports fishermen. They have strong organizations, well-financed, and the political pressures cannot be resisted by public officials.
Maybe I can ask others, Dr. Usher in particular, since he's very familiar with these management conflicts, to comment in the first part of the statement.
Well, I think there's two areas that, certainly in the territories, that Native people have been very concerned about in this whole problem of game, and it relates closely to how you're going to develop renewable resources after a settlement. Okay, first of all, who has access to these resources? Fortunately, in Canada, in northern Canada at least, the Aboriginal right, hunting, fishing, and trapping rights of Native people are well recognized and have only recently been encroached on, let's say in the NWT, only in the last 12 or 15 years or so, by increasing availability of general hunting licenses to non-Native people under special conditions. We're getting into a situation now where that kind of thing might work in terms of game management, where you have a tiny minority of non-Natives, but when you look forward to a time when there might be tremendous numbers of non-Native people and you allow every one of them to go out and get 5 caribou a year, you're in serious trouble managing that resource. So it's high on the agenda to settle that question of access to resources, and I think if it's going to be resolved to the satisfaction of Native people, it'll have to be essentially that they are the ones with sole access to the resource. The other thing is, it's all very well to have the right to hunt and trap on unutilized Crown lands. Quite another when conflicting activities on those lands leave you nothing to hunt and trap. You've got a right, but what good is it? And here's where the question of control of development comes in, and I think that if the renewable resources are to be maintained, then it'll have to be Native people will have to have control over much more than just the lands which they may ultimately select in a land claim settlement. They're going to have to be able to have very substantial control over land use practices and land use regulation in lands which are open to industrial development. The experience in the Northwest Territories is anything to go by. The present system of land use regulation simply will not do the job. I think that the people with the primary interest in those resources will have to be the ones who set the controls on it, because obviously we cannot trust either Ottawa or Calgary or whatever to make these decisions on behalf of Native Northerners.
Maybe I'll go on to the second point that was raised, and that was one that you raised, Ian,
with regards to tax incentives to the mining industry and the royalty situation for the mining industry. And it was felt that that government aid, direct or indirect as it may be, was really not very different in case from the government aid that assistance to business in renewable enterprises or non-renewable enterprises to native businesses that would come through a lands claim would be generated. Now, the point that was raised from that is there was some concern that that differentiation, saying it's okay for the mining industry to get the government aid, but not for smaller native businesses, might reflect some kind of disposition of the business community towards the involvement of natives in a variety of enterprises in the territory. Could you respond to that sort of statement?
Yes, Bob. My point about the mining incentives was to point out that it's not a well-founded industry in some cases that it does need incentives to exist. My point about the tax advantages based on a racial type of criteria was that if two businesses were trying to perform the same function, why should one have an advantage over another from a tax point of view? And the given in all that is that presumably the point of the land claim settlement, the money part, the capitalization part, is to allow the native people to overcome some inherent disadvantages that they have right now in a lack of capital, perhaps a lack of expertise and management, some of these things, to give them that start. And it comes to the question of weighing how much of a start do they need, and that's a fairly tough one to generalize on.
Then maybe I can follow that up with a second concern that was raised in relation to competition. And it was felt that by and large the condition you described may give rise to unfair competition. And in our group, another element was thrown into that, and that was that whatever competition is looked at or is entered into, one should look very carefully at the mechanism of cash flow. If you are involved in competition with an interest whose cash flow is immediately out of the territory, and the native business may have a cash flow which circulates more effectively within the territory, then in fact that competition may well be worthwhile encouraging, subsidized or otherwise. The other aspect of this conflict relates to something Dr. Usher touched on, and which is raised in our group. If I can give an analogy, it's like providing money for tote road assistance and building a tote road and access, and in doing so, eliminating the option or the use of that land for a renewable resource, so that you are, in an indirect competition, pitting one resource against another. I just open that issue of competition up for your comments, and I invite other members on the panel to give their comments on this as well.
Maybe, Bob, if I could take the first swing at that. First of all, there was one point in your first question. There is, as far as I know, no feeling in the business community of anti-Indian involvement in business. I'm very encouraged when I see quite a number of Indian people getting involved in business. I think it's great. Going back to your competition within the territory, I'd like to maybe restate a point I made there. I was sort of illustrating about Tesla, how it could be that only one store could operate there. Bill Weber told me afterwards that I was closer to the point than I thought, because before the highway came in, there was an Indian store there owned by Indian people. The highway came through, and then there's a white businessman went in and started up, and the Indian store went broke. Now, that's exactly the point I was trying to make, is that and I'm not trying to draw racial lines, I'm just trying to draw economic conclusions, is that it's sometimes better to eliminate your competition by buying it out than it is by going head on against it. So I'm not trying to say don't touch our business, we got it made. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that when you do get into business, make sure you get into the right way. Now, just sorry, Bob, one more thing you were saying about competition of local business versus outside business. I agree 100%. I personally, making my living in the Whitehorse here as a chartered accountant, suffering competition from outside all the time. And I'm trying to get as much business as I can to keep it in the territory. And the more business that goes like that, the better it is for everybody living here. So I agree. That's a very viable point.
Care to comment on the issue of conflicts and conflicts in business?
Yeah, I'd just like to respond a bit to that. I believe in a lot of cases some of the ideas that people have been coming up with aren't really in competition with other businesses. In fact, a lot of them are new development incentives. And especially, I'd just like to point at one is in the area of the fur industry. Right now, we're shipping raw furs out of the territory, you know, hundreds of thousand dollars worth. And these go down to another province. And that province makes all kinds of money by processing them and turning them into goods for fashion industries over in Paris and things like this. And if we could develop these kind of industries, I think we as a territory would be much better off, you know, just as one example.
Anybody else want to comment on
that? Then I only have one last comment that was raised in our group. I'm sure I've missed some of them. This dwells on the dilemma that Mr. Noddy touched on in terms of the aspirations or desires of people in communities, and maybe symbolic of that, we don't want a road coming into our town, kind of notion, which is I read, and I think many other people read, is an attachment to a traditional lifestyle or subsistence. I'm not sure that terminology is particularly appropriate for the kind of model we were looking at, as opposed to the kind of business enterprise that it seems that the regional corporations are becoming obliged to become involved in without any alternatives. I'd also like to have the people in the Yukon comment on this, because if this is in our horizon from the land's claims, doesn't it end up in a divisive situation where regional organizations are doing something quite different than it's aspired to by people in the rural communities?
Well, in the in our region, if the region got too far out of line with what the villages wanted, I assure you that they will take care of it through the elective process and replace the directors at the regional level. There's not too much opposition to railroads, but if we look at the map of Alaska and the game populations and the strip development that takes place, the villages just have decided for the most part that they don't want any part of it. And the regions in the resource development, at least in our region, have been very careful to explore in areas where we feel the impact of getting any resource out can be taken care of without developing a big infrastructure of roads that will tie the villages to any of the major centers.
I think a lot of our people are thinking of going back to their traditional villages. I think one good example is Ajak. People have been living there for hundreds of years, and the government built an airport there, and when they pulled out, they told the people that you couldn't live there because, you know, we can't live there ourselves, so you can't live there, so we're moving you to Haines Junction. And so they move most of the people to Haines Junction. There's no place for them to hunt or fish or anything, and so all they can do is collect welfare. Whereas when they were in Ajak, they could fish and they could hunt, and the lake was right there, and they didn't have to collect any welfare. Those are some of the examples. And I think more of the communities now, especially the older people, are want to go back to certain areas where they can to live off the land more or less. I think Burwash is a real prime example of that. I think there are quite a few of the older people who like to move away from the village areas and get back to where there's no alcohol and other problems that we're having in our villages.
Frank, you have a question?
This is for Mr. Mackay. There's developed in my mind a little bit of confusion in the last little while about businesses, and I welcome the opportunity maybe to clear some of these up. In the papers for the last little while, I've been noticing under the Registers Act an increasing number of companies being registered, and usually what they'll say is that they got capital assets or whatever the correct phraseology is, so many shares. It's usually in Calgary or Vancouver or whatnot. I'm wondering in the relationship between the pipeline and the land claims, and if you talk of economic development of native corporations or whatever, or native individual or community corporations, how many of these companies that are coming up now on the basis of the pipeline before there's been any land claim settlement are going to be going into businesses that would potentially offer opportunities for native companies with the influx of a cash settlement? And also it gets into the local control versus outside control. Does the Chamber of Commerce react when there is a big influx of outside companies where they have their headquarters in, say, Calgary or Edmonton or Vancouver?
Can I answer one?
Sure.
Okay. I just don't know which companies are coming up right now.
Well, you can usually see in most editions of the paper they have a new listing of a company that gets registered in with one of the lawyers in town.
Yeah, I know of the listings, but as I say, I don't know of what kind of operation they're doing. The ones I'm aware of, without knowing which companies you're talking about, are the ones I've seen are in here buying commercial property in the main. They appear to be quite a number of speculators coming into town and purchasing commercial property, which has kind of doubled in price in the last 3 months in Whitehorse. And they're picking up highway property for storage purposes, pipe, motels, office buildings, just anything. And I don't think they're necessarily preempting the Indian corporations from some of the activities that will be flowing from the pipeline. I think there's been some good buys made. If the Indians had their money, they might have been able to get some of the good buys as well.
I probably think so. I hope there's going to be a few good buys left over by the
yeah.
time. Another thing has to do with ethics of the business community. And you earlier mentioned legal rights or moral rights to the land claims. Another thing I've been noticing in the papers is up around the McMillan Pass for about the last 2 months, every couple of editions, there's a long, long list of claims. I'm wondering, is this a land claim settlement or is it not a land claim settlement? And if it's involving land, what right does a company have while negotiation is going on to go out? And I'm not sure of the area that they've claimed, but there was again in Fridays, and it's again Vancouver. There's some guy in Parnell, and I think all he does is spend his whole day is writing down the numbers of the claims, talking about northeast of Summit Lake or north of Summit Lake in so many miles. How can we talk about morality or legality when that's going? What is the position of the business community on that?
Okay, mining claims are the subsurface rights to the property. This has been well established in law, and I'm not just sure how much of the subsurface rights are being negotiated under the land claims. I suspect in the land that's being claimed for living purposes that the subsurface rights will go there.
Is that fair to distinguish? You're talking, I don't care if it's above land or below land, it's land. And if we're talking about right to a land, that if there is some inherent right that the people have here through Aboriginal rights, how can that be violated while negotiations are going on in trust? How can the business community, the mining company, come in and do that? Because I really, every time I pick up the paper and I see more claims, I'm wondering, what the hell is going on? You know, is there a claim settlement or is there not a claim settlement?
Well, I would suggest that it's to the advantage of everybody for continued exploration for minerals.
Directed to you, Emil Noddy. Could you tell us something about the Alaska settlement model? What was the process of negotiation? Or was it was it in fact a negotiation, or was it legislated by Congress? And the second part of that really is, was the Alaska land claim settlement based on money and real estate, or did it go further than that, as is our understanding from the Yukon land claim settlement?
They like to characterize Alaska land claim settlement as one that was negotiated. But I don't think it can be called a true negotiation session. We put down and argued for the things that we wanted, that we thought would encompass a fair settlement, and Congress went behind closed doors and wrote the law of the land, and that was it. We lost some major points. The biggest loss I think we lost, that we could not hold on to, was we wanted 2% in perpetuity. We said if the land was worth nothing, the native people will get nothing. If the land had any value or anything in the land, then we wanted to participate in it. So we asked for 2% forever. Congress said, well, we don't know what that's going to cost, and we're not writing any open-ended checks. And so they refused to go along with it. They put a limit of $500 million on resources, and we think that'll be paid off in 10 or 12 years once the oil starts flowing at capacity in the pipeline. So you can see that it was a major loss. One of the arguments used was that Native people didn't dig for oil, so therefore shouldn't participate. And during testimony, that point was made, and so our response was, well, we know farmers that farmed down in West Texas and Oklahoma on 40 acres of dry, dusty land and broke their back raising cotton, and they weren't digging for any holes in the ground, and somebody tapped them on the shoulder one day and said, we'll give you 12.5% of anything we find down there, and that was fine. So if we were really true owners of the land, we should participate, because nothing in the history of the westward movement gave us any optimism about how Native people would be treated. And the best way to prevent Indian people from becoming bystanders in a development area would be to get a royalty, if nothing else. And I think it was proven out in the pipeline construction. The villagers, by and large, did not participate in that construction. There was a requirement that they have 20% minority hire and set-asides for contracts. They were hiring and firing guys, and the last hired and the first fired of Native people. And it turns out that a university study going on now, one of the guys who was doing the study told me that on a man-hour basis, it's turning out that Indian people got between 1% and 2% of the construction time. So there again, we think that our point was valid, that we're not going to participate in any development unless it's mandated and written into law. So that was a major loss. So it was not, I don't feel, a negotiated settlement. On the money and land, we wanted to, well, first of all, we felt that you could only get title to land in three ways. You win it in war, you take it away from somebody, or somebody gives it to you, or you sell it. And the Indian people in Alaska had never done any one of those. Never been defeated, and didn't give it away, and didn't sign any deeds, and had never sold it. So we wanted 10% of the land and payment for the rest of it. We got $900 million for 335 million acres of land, and the state of Alaska got $900 million for 200,000 acres of land. So some people might say it really wasn't a fair settlement. We think the 2% in perpetuity might have corrected any glaring inequities in time. I don't know if I answered it adequately, but that's... No, I think they are asking for more than we asked for, and there are some very important differences, in especially in the area of almost sovereignty in policy making, and if I understand some of it, the guaranteed seats in the legislature. And we never did ask for any of that. And if they're successful, they will have achieved much more than we were able to achieve.
We wanted to check out an impression, too, Mr. Naughty, whether the impression we got in our group was correct or not. I think the impression that we got was your corporate structure, your structure of regional and village corporations, was actually geared towards the assimilation of the native people. For example, the conflict with exploration on native lands and a conflict with native lifestyle. Also, the examples you've given us so far, except for the hotel, being non-renewable resource development rather than renewable resource development. Was our impression correct? And we got the impression also that perhaps the native people in the villages weren't as happy about the settlement as they might have been.
I think both impressions are accurate. I think the act is clearly intended to assimilate native people into the economy and in many ways terminate what's called termination in the other states, any special rights that Indians have as far as taxation goes, or rights to fish and game. I think both of those were effectively terminated in the Alaska Land Claims Act. I think it's fair to say that the villagers are not happy, because even though 40 million acres is a lot of land, studies have shown that they cannot make a living off of that amount of land, and the land will not provide for the outside pressures and still allow villages to continue the kind of life that they would like to continue.
Thank you. We had several other follow-up questions, but the individuals were going to ask those themselves.
Actually, I'd like to ask a question that sort of follows up on that one. That is along the lines of what, is it Mr. Nettie? Sorry. Yeah, has said. What would the representatives over here, I don't know your names either, what would you have to say about how some of the things that have happened in Alaska, as far as the way their settlement, the corporate settlement was established, how can some of the negative effects be prevented here? If I understand that what Mr. Nettie said was that, okay, the corporate structure is designed to assimilate, and is there any way that this can be prevented in your land settlement in the Yukon?
I think, fortunately for us, the settlement did take place in Alaska prior to Yukon, and we can learn a lot from sort of what what their settlement reflects and some of the problems that they've run into. And we'll certainly try and ensure that that the corporate structures don't don't take a thrust toward total assimilation or assimilation, unless some particular community wanted to get into that type of area, like an urban center like Whitehorse. In a lot of cases, a number of people have aspirations toward assimilation, and that could probably take place. I don't think we're going to say one way or the other. We're not going to tell the people how they should operate. I believe in Alaska. I don't know if that's a fair interpretation. I don't think your corporations there are just taking a thrust toward assimilation, are they?
Well, there's no profit in providing education or culture, and it's hard enough to try to make a dollar without getting into the social program. So the corporations don't have any choice. Along with each profit corporation, there is a non-profit corporation that is funded by Health and Welfare and Bureau of Indian Affairs that does provide for social programs and concerns. But under land claims, the regional corporations don't have very much choice if they're going to survive.
Can I just ask a quick question just further to that? Is what kind of, in the Yukon then, what kind of structure is being considered other than corporations? Is there anything else being considered in view of what corporations seem to implicitly do?
Well, we're just researching that issues, and it's a real hard question to find a corporation that can fill all those needs. Getting away from corporations, there have to be more studies done. We have looked into other areas, and if we go outside the realm of corporation, then it becomes into a new realm of law, and I'm not an expert in law, so I can't answer that. But I think what we like to base some of our needs is that we want to start building on a little bit on our culture and start having bring back a lot of our languages back to the schools and that sort of thing we're looking at.
Peter, I wonder if you could perhaps make a comment on alternative structures for economic control other than corporations, or is that a fair way to phrase the question?
That's really the most difficult area, I think, I'm not really sure what to say to that, because I think the whole area of structures is something that the Native organizations are going to have to work out for themselves, and I don't know that outsiders really have much to say in a way about that, except maybe to suggest what some of the options are. In the Northwest Territories, the cooperative movement is fairly well established. Institutionally, what that means as an alternative, I'm not quite sure, but it's there. It has a history of 20 years or so, and some communities have organized. Some of the small rural communities have organized virtually all the cash aspect of their economic development around cooperatives. That may be one alternative.
It's been a long evening for our panelists as well as for the members of our audience. We're dwindling away like the unfinished symphony. And I'll take one more question if there is one. If not, I would like to thank you all for coming and remind you that we're back in session next Sunday night. Rob, would you like to say a word about content for next Sunday, 7 o'clock at FH Collins?